We are your hosts, Nikki Shore and Jesse Swain, and you are listening to the American Journal of Infection Control podcast, Science into Practice, brought to you by the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology to highlight work published in our peer-reviewed journal, AICHIC.
Join us as we speak to those in the field of infection prevention and control, like us, as well as other experts to learn about some of the latest research in the field and how it can be put into practice. We hope you will listen in, learn something new, and apply this information to your work. If you are not a researcher already, we hope this podcast will get you thinking about areas where you can carry out your own research. To link to the articles we are discussing today, go to our website at www.aigicscienceintopractice.org. This is episode one on MRSA in outpatient settings and antibiotic stewardship. I'm Jesse Swain, and I'm an IP with my master's in business administration and began my career as a medical lab tech.
I'm Nikki Shore, and I'm an infection preventionist that started out as an ICU nurse. And we look forward to helping connect you to the research in our field and get insight from researchers who help us carry out the APIC mission to advance the science of infection prevention and control. Jesse, are you ready to get started?
Sure am.
You know, we have a pretty interesting topic today. You know, I feel like we have a pretty solid infection prevention program and techniques for the inpatient hospital settings. How do you feel about your outpatient settings?
Yeah, Nikki, I think you're right. I'm not confident that we have a good grasp on managing resistant bacteria in the ambulatory setting. We're excited today, though, to have Dr. Curtis Donsky with us to discuss this issue. Dr. Donsky is a professor of medicine at Case Western Reserve University and staff physician in the infectious diseases section at the Lewis Stokes Cleveland Veterans Affairs Medical Center. He's also the chairman of infection control committee at the Cleveland Veterans Affairs Medical Center. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Donsky. Can you start us off by telling us a little bit about what prompted this research?
So we and of course a lot of others have looked at shedding of organisms and pathogens in hospital rooms and in nursing homes. And many, many studies have documented shedding of gram-negatives, C. diff, VRE, and MRSA in those settings. And we had recently done studies looking with specifically at MRSA and resistant gram-negatives. So we were very interested in the outpatient setting and settings outside of rooms for the reasons that you mentioned, that we know that many of our patients are going for appointments in radiology and physical therapy and elsewhere all over the hospital. And we're being very careful with cleaning in the inpatient rooms and in with infection control measures, but much less so, at least paying much less attention in outpatient settings and in settings outside of patient rooms. So it's a very good area to look at, in particular because we are cleaning diligently in patient rooms, but we're not monitoring cleaning in outpatient settings or in radiology. And we clean after every patient in the hospital room, but many, many patients are rapidly coming through outpatient clinics and other settings without really adequate time to do adequate cleaning.
Yeah, and I noticed from the study, it looks like wounds with MRSA are the most frequent offenders of environmental shedding, and it seems to have occurred most frequently in physical therapy areas. And I'm assuming, but I don't want to assume, so let me run this past you. Is there more shedding in the PT areas because that's typically where wound care is being performed, or do some of those other clinics just have different decolonizing or cleaning protocols, or just because the patients in the PT areas are more mobile? Why do you think that there's more shedding in the physical therapy areas?
So in physical therapy, patients are, touching physical therapy items and, moving actively. And there's a lot of potential for transmission, both from their hands. So patients with MRSA often have hand contamination. And we have found that many of our patients in our facility have contamination of their clothing as well. And so you can easily, if you're sitting in a physical therapy area, you can transfer MRSA from your clothing. You can transfer it when you touch items. So it's just a high risk area. We do not typically have, you know, patients have their wounds typically covered in physical therapy. So transmission in that setting really is more from the clothing, hands, and skin of the patients.
So do you think the findings from the study suggest any key areas of focus for the cleaning and disinfection in the room based on what you saw when you did the culturing?
Most of the contamination that we saw was in the patient area. So patients would be sitting on the exam table or with the exam table where they sat, or items that they had touched. Less often we saw contamination on computer keyboards and chairs where the providers were sitting. And when we did see that, it was actually exactly what you might expect. We would observe that a provider would touch the patient and be examining the patient and then go and then work on their keyboard without doing the hand hygiene in between. And so you can transfer those organisms from the patient to your workstation easily in that regard. But for the more of the contamination occurred right where the patient was sitting and touching.
So it sounds like some of the opportunities we may have is re-educating providers on hand hygiene moments.
Yes, absolutely. And we've seen the same thing in patient rooms as well. You know, individuals will touch portable equipment and the equipment will become contaminated when they're working with an MRSA patient. So yes, absolutely. In addition to cleaning, there's also a need for providers to really be aware that when you're touching the patient, you can transfer those organisms to anything else that you touch.
It sounds like that might be similar education that would be good for the patients as well. Since we're talking about, you know, it's known that they're carrying these organisms on their hands. So, you know, especially in that PT area where they're doing a lot of touching of equipment and things like that, that would be a good opportunity for education for the patients themselves, perhaps as well. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good point. We really strongly advocate patient hand hygiene. So patients, for example, going to physical therapy, doing hand hygiene before you begin touching all of these shared items and going to lunch and so on. Other things, again, patients' clothing can be contaminated and skin. So we, you know, encourage patients to do good hygiene in terms of bathing and changing their clothing while they're in the hospital or nursing home as well are good measures.
So how do you think that reinforces the use of PPE, especially since you all note the importance of interventions that reduce clothing contamination like you were talking about? So is this something that we should encourage patients to do as well? Providers seem to be pretty good, at least in the inpatient hospital setting, about putting on their gowns and their gloves. I don't know about the outpatient setting, how well that's adhered to. Any thoughts on that?
Yes. So I agree with that statement that, you know, in the outpatient setting, our study nicely showed that you could get environmental contamination when patients are cared for in that setting. Other studies have shown that providers who are working with patients can often get contamination on their gown or on their gloves as they're providing patient care. So, in addition to environmental cleaning after patients are in outpatient rooms, the findings overall, our findings in conjunction with other studies, really reinforce use of PPE as well. You know, gloves, in particular, if you're taking care of a patient who has C. diff infection, where, you know, standard alcohol hand hygiene is not going to be effective, wearing gloves for patients who come to your outpatient clinic who previously had C. diff is I think a very good practice.
I know in some cases, we in our own facility have noted that sometimes when clinicians are wearing gloves and other PPE, that Oftentimes there's moments where, you know, they're either touching other surfaces after touching patients, still wearing that PPE, or they're removing that PPE and then not following up with appropriate hand hygiene. Do you think that this is also a contributing factor to some of this transmission to surfaces?
Yes, I do. And again, in our study, we really, I think, demonstrated that with hands, you know, touching patients and then going to keyboards and other areas. For glove use, you know, certainly it's important to educate providers that you have to do hand hygiene after removing your gloves.
And this is good education for the patients too, for home care. So under the risk factors that you all have listed in the table, the risk factors for shedding of MRSA during their appointments, wounds with MRSA were the most statistically significant. Those are that's the highest risk of shedding. So when these patients go home with wounds, whether they're kind of caring for their own wounds at home or not, I don't think that we do enough education with those patients about hand hygiene, environmental cleaning, making sure that you're changing clothes and keeping a clean environment when you're caring for that stuff. So it opens up a lot of educational opportunities.
I agree. And this is a very common question that we receive is, you know, how worried should I be about my family members acquiring the MRSA or the C. diff that I have? And so this is something that when that question is asked, we always, reinforce all of those measures that you mentioned. We need to practice good hand hygiene, keep your wound covered, change your clothing, and wash clothing regularly. All of those things can help reduce the risk of recurrence of an infection after it's been treated. So absolutely, those are important points to make.
Another interesting takeaway I thought was that the gram-negative organism shedding was not a significant finding. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on why it was more the MRSA that, you know, seemed to be the issue than the gram negatives.
So we find that, you know, MRSA is more hardy in terms of survival on surfaces. So in general, our experience over many studies has been that MRSA is more easily recovered from surfaces and it can persist on surfaces longer than gram-negative pathogens. Although we sometimes think, you know, Acinetobacter is an exception to that rule. It tends to survive on surfaces. In the current study, we only looked at 11 patients who were colonized with either CRE or ESBL producing gram negatives. So I think the number of patients was relatively small. We didn't see any shedding in this study, but in a previous study in hospital rooms, we did see environmental contamination with gram negatives, again, to a lesser extent than we saw with MRSA.
I found that very interesting too, Jesse. I'm glad you asked that. And I noticed that VRE was excluded from the study.
So VRE, I think would be very similar in terms of data in comparison to MRSA. There's a previous study from actually back in 1998 where they found in outpatient clinics that 29% of encounters with VRE patients resulted in environmental contamination. So VRE is another organism that the environment is a significant concern, and shedding in outpatient settings as well. The only reason we excluded VRE in the current study is that we currently are not screening for VRE in our healthcare facility. And so we had a very limited number of potential patients to include.
I think, the thing that we have found to be most challenging is you don't know what you don't know. So, you know, we have patients coming for these outpatient appointments who, you know, they may have been diagnosed with MRSA or, you know, other highly resistant organism or C. diff or whatever it may be, either somewhere else or even in our facility, but being able to efficiently track these patients to provide sort of better mitigation strategies, use of PPE, those types of things, has sort of been one of those things we haven't been able to get a really good grasp on. Do you have any ideas or suggestions of things that you think might be helpful in getting a better handle on keeping track or knowing when these patients are coming in for these appointments?
So I think it's very difficult to track the patients. And so this is really one of the debates that we have in infection control related to these, these types of organisms. Should we focus on patients who are known to be colonized with MRSA or resistant gram negatives, or should we target, specific high risk activities or patients who are likely to be colonized? So there's some very, interesting data from nursing home that focuses on nursing homes where they have focused really on targeting high risk activities. So if you are doing wound care or assisting with hygiene, that would be considered a high risk activity, whereas passing a medication would not be, or assisting with a meal would not be considered a high risk activity. And then also focusing on high risk patients, so patients with wounds or devices, you would focus your infection prevention efforts on that. And you could really do the same thing in outpatient settings. It really hasn't been discussed in outpatient as much, but rather than focusing on, is an MRSA patient coming to my clinic? The question would be, as I see the patient, if they're a patient who has an indwelling urinary catheter or a wound, that would be a high risk patient. And if I'm going to do a high risk activity with that patient, wound care and so on, then I would take extra measures to, wear gloves, potentially even wear a gown, depending on how much contamination I anticipate, and then do a little cleaning after that patient leaves. That, that's, I think probably the best option for most outpatient settings. I would just mention that there is a nice, study from Susan Wong's group from the New England Journal in 2019, where they looked at post-discharge infections in MRSA colonized patients. And what they did is they identified the patients in the hospital and then gave them twice a month, they would give them 5 days of mupirocin and chlorhexidine. And that reduced MRSA infections by 30% overall and by 44% if you were very compliant with those procedures. And so outpatient clinics could potentially, if we begin to expand that type of practice in MRSA carriers, outpatient clinics might be involved in supporting that type of practice, because we want, it really looks like post-discharge is a high-risk time for infections in MRSA colonized patients, and there is a potential intervention that we can use to reduce that.
So that was one of the questions that came up as I read this article was, it indicates that chlorhexidine bathing could be beneficial for patients in the outpatient setting. I think facilitating that will probably have a few bumps in the road, because most of the time that is a series of bathing. It happens over a couple of days. And when you have multi-step interventions that are outside of your control, I worry about patient compliance. And do you have any opinions on that? I was kind of mulling that over in my head on how you can facilitate the chlorhexidine bathing with patients in the outpatient setting. And I'm just not exactly sure how that would look like.
Yeah, I think that would probably have to be facilitated through primary care providers. Again, identify in the study, they identified patients in the hospital with MRSA and then gave them education at the time they were leaving the hospital. and you know, the outpatient setting would really simply be a means of reinforcing the importance of doing those types of procedures, you know, the chlorhexidine, mupirocin approaches.
I'm curious too, were any of the healthcare personnel swabbed for the study?
Yes, so we did not swab personnel in this study. I think, you know, as I mentioned before, I think there is pretty impressive data showing that if you are providing care for a patient with MRSA or resistant gram negatives or other pathogens, that you can easily contaminate your clothing and your hands with those pathogens during you know, high risk activities such as wound care. So personnel become contaminated with those organisms on our hands and on our clothing, and we obviously want to avoid that. So that's we anticipate that personnel transiently become contaminated during those types of procedures. We, you know, surprisingly, you know, healthcare personnel often, if you ask them, they'll all say, well, I'm sure I must be colonized with MRSA. I take care of MRSA patients all day. When we actually do surveys to look at that, actually nasal carriage of MRSA in our facility was only 5%, even though when we ask them, personnel, it was like 40% of them said, I must be colonized with MRSA. So we transiently become contaminated, our clothing gets contaminated with these types of organisms, but luckily, you know, we have good defenses, we don't have devices, and hopefully we're not taking antibiotics unless they're absolutely necessary. So we have good defenses against becoming actually colonized with these pathogens.
Dr. Donsky, I'm one of those offenders. I have always assumed I'm a carrier of all kinds of multi-drug resistant organisms. So good. That gives me some faith that maybe I'm clean.
Yes. I'm also one of those people because I actually ran the C. diff testing in the lab. So I always say I'm probably colonized because I probably picked it up there. Yeah, I think that's super interesting. And you know, we've tried some other, I think, mitigation sort of strategies with around like the clothing being becoming contaminated. Our infectious disease doctors, many of them will not wear ties on days that they are seeing patients, you know, so they're not leaning in and having a tie draping over a patient. One of the other strategies we've used is bare below the elbows. So, you know, encouraging clinicians to not wear watches, even anything other than flat wedding bands, and rolling up their sleeves or wearing short-sleeved attire when they're seeing patients. Is this something that you've seen out there?
Yeah, so I'm in favor of anything that allows me to not wear a tie.
It's the age of the bow tie. We could really bring this back.
Yeah, I'm not really a bow tie person, but
no tie.
But you know, bare below the elbows, we did you know, there's a lot of interest in that as a concept, and but not a lot of data on actually whether that reduces risk for transmission. We did a simulation study a few years ago where we contaminated surfaces with a benign virus. And then we had individuals do a simulated exam with or without the bare below the elbows approach. And we actually showed that wearing long sleeves, you know, white coats was associated with an increased risk for transmission of those surrogate markers from one mannequin to another. So, you know, I think that in potentially is a good practice. I certainly don't disagree with that if anybody wants to do that. And certainly as I'm rounding myself or as I observe people rounding, it's not uncommon at all to see the white coat, the sleeve of the white coat or the tie for that matter, you know, kidding the MRSA colonized patient.
Fantastic. Well, I think we've just about met our time limit for today. So we definitely want to thank you, Dr. Donsky, for joining us and enlightening us with all of that fantastic information.
Any parting words for us?
Only that I think this clearly is an area that that needs more attention. We pay a lot of attention in the hospital. This is a good opportunity to look at the data and think about our outpatient settings and radiology and physical therapy. So
we very much agree. We were talking about that earlier, going over the article, and we couldn't agree more. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Donsky.
Thank you.
So, Jesse, we've already mentioned that infection prevention is everybody's responsibility. So it only makes sense that we use all the brains we can to reach our goals, right?
Absolutely.
So our next guest has expertise in just that. We have Dr. Linda McKinley, a highly experienced infection preventionist and current research health scientist at Madison, Wisconsin's VA. She is an APIC fellow and has received an Army Commendation Medal for her leadership work. She recently published an article called Integrating Antibiotic Stewardship in Infection Prevention and Control Programs Using a Team Science Approach in AGIC. So who better to talk to us about integrating antimicrobial stewardship and infection prevention programs? Welcome, Dr. McKinley, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Jesse and I are both pretty passionate about interdisciplinary teams, and your article gives a great framework for doing just that. So I wonder if you can start off our conversation by giving us your opinion on why it's important to bring different expertise to the table. And by the table, I mean any table.
So as an infection preventionist, we do end up working with all sorts of disciplines within the healthcare community. And I think I'm just going to give an example of something I participated in that gives a really nice illustration of why it's important to bring different disciplines to the table. And many of you may have been involved in something like this. They're called survival training, and it's used for teamwork building. And they give you a survival scenario, and each individual determines what they need to survive in this particular situation, and they get a score. And then the group comes together and they then decide which tools they need to survive in that situation. And almost always the group gets a better score than the individual. So, you know, this idea that different disciplines bring different, specialties, different diversity, and that it becomes synergized when you get together. So you end up with a better idea of what's happening, a better solution to what is happening. And I guess that, in a nutshell, is a way that I would describe why it's important.
Yeah. And you talk in the paper, you have some work around C. diff, and you also mention urine testing for UTIs. And I wonder if there are some other areas of diagnostic stewardship within the healthcare setting that could benefit from the whole antimicrobial stewardship program and infection prevention and control interaction.
Yeah, I recently just read a very brief article from the ID News, and it talked about low-hanging fruit for lab stewardship. And in addition to urine cultures, any of the cultures, so blood cultures, sputum cultures, stool cultures, they are all low-hanging fruit in which we want to make sure that the test is needed, that the test is interpreted correctly. As we know, especially in infection control, there's quite a differentiation between disease and either contamination or disease and colonization. And not all of those require antimicrobial treatment. And so, yeah, I think we have tons of work that we can do in this lab stewardship. And I'm just really excited that that is a whole new field of study, lab stewardship.
Right. And I feel like, especially with antimicrobial stewardship and infection prevention, is comprised a lot of nurses and micro and lab. Those are two of, in probably Jesse's opinion, I don't want to speak for her, but probably some of the most important disciplines to bring to the table. But what are some other healthcare focuses, and what are some other disciplines that could benefit from these multidisciplinary approaches that might not be traditional?
Well, I really think anybody that's involved in either ordering tests or ordering antimicrobials, anybody who's involved, I mean, you know, traditionally nurses aren't involved in ordering, but they are definitely involved in recommending testing. And so, you know, anybody that's involved in somehow the transmission of information to somebody who's ordering a test or ordering the antimicrobials, and definitely anybody who's interpreting those results. And I'm also going to just say that it's going to be really important for us to include patients, because patients are actually asking for tests and asking for antimicrobials. Mm-hmm. So we definitely need to learn how to involve patients in these discussions.
That's a really good point. I feel like that we've been hearing a lot of discussions around antimicrobial stewardship and the fact that patients do ask for antibiotics for a lot of things. And sometimes the provider sort of feels pressured to give an antibiotic because it will, you know, make the patient feel better in a sense that they feel like there's some sort of solution coming to whatever the issue is. But again, knowing that that isn't always the appropriate solution, it makes sense to involve patients and start providing more education and things like that too. But to your point with the lab, I actually have a lab background, and I like the fact that we're now seeing more teams of infection preventionists integrating, you know, people with laboratory expertise and then our nursing colleagues to help form a more collaborative infection prevention team as well. And understanding some of those different backgrounds, I think has been helpful. One of my big questions after reading your article was, you know, how do you get buy-in from leadership when you're to form these collaborative teams when you're competing with staffing shortages and other priorities in your institutions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, there's another whole field of study on looking in implementation science at looking at readiness. And I don't know, I think you can kind of look at it multiple different ways. You can, there's certainly tons of tools out there that you can use to do a formal readiness survey. You know, AHRQ has them. There's even a whole website that gives you an algorithm to go down whatever paths you need to determine which readiness tool that might be best for your situation. But I definitely think there's more, you know, informal ways that you can, you know, assess readiness. Certainly, you know, when you're thinking about doing some sort of intervention and you're determining where this is going to happen, you know, for people who are in their facilities, they know which units are more engaged. You know, you might want to start there. Units that have already implemented something and found some success. But you definitely need to have that ground level, not only leadership, but you need to have the staff people that are involved in those different interventions to be engaged. So that readiness assessment really is really depending on the context within which it occurs. And only you at that facility can really determine that and get the buy-in from those areas. But having those multidisciplinary team members are also going to be really important there. You know, having the different disciplines talking about the importance really can bring that to the forefront to leadership and to the staff.
And in sort of talking about these multidisciplinary groups and bringing people with different experiences and, you know, backgrounds together, there was mentioned something about psychological safety within those teams. Can you talk a little bit more about your thoughts on that?
Trust is an important component of any sort of team. And, Many infection control practitioners have participated in different collaboratives that have used the team steps kind of framework that kind of revolves around team communication. But a big component of that is trust and psychological safety. So the same with this framework that we're talking about here with this team science, what really focuses on collaboration, that there has to be a sense of trust within the group. So, you know, we point out in this article kind of the mainstay of team forming, some of the steps that are required in that. But, you know, there are just some practical solutions to trying to building that trust. But it really is just over time, even conflict and conflict resolution can develop trust within team members.
Which is a great point, because you talk about respectful disagreement in the article when you're facilitating conflict management. Do you have any key phrases or approaches that you have found helpful that the audience might be able to pick up and use when they're having these difficult conversations?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you always want to kind of start your team meetings with acknowledging that conflict will occur and that conflict is normal. And the other thing is to maybe just kind of know, doing like a self-assessment on how you deal with conflict. And, you know, do you try to avoid it? Are you more defensive? And so kind of knowing your style and maybe some of the styles of the other people on your team. But, you know, the thing is that we also want to just get past looking at it as just conflict and maybe resistance to change, in that we really need to try to understand what that conflict is. What is the basis of that conflict? Because in many times in my experience is that conflict, there really is a reason for that conflict. And we really want to explore what that reason is and try to address that. Because especially, you know, when you're dealing with frontline staff, they know how, you know, the system is working on the ground, and they have insights that other people might not have. And we really need to dig deep and try to understand what that conflict is, and understand it so we can try to address it. It might be compromise, but it might be, shifting of your intervention needs to occur.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely one thing I've learned over the past 5 years in this role was, you know, observing how important the frontline staff are in understanding workflows and things around decision making that affects them. So that, yeah, that's definitely a great point.
And being flexible, because it may have been a little while since we IPs have been at the bedside. You know, we're rounding and seeing things, but it may be that we forget what it's like to be at the front line. So being flexible and realizing like, oh, okay, practices may have changed and we need to be able to pivot and move in a different direction. So the team really has to be flexible and open, and coming to it with an open mind.
Yeah, I like that term, flexibility.
And I guess that's kind of, you know, you talk in the paper about the form, norm, storm, perform. And right. A good time to take advantage of that is during the forming session, which is kind of the honeymoon phase of a project. So you're really connecting everybody to the same goal. I think that's kind of it. You know, you're setting the goal at the first meeting and taking advantage.
I mean, that is, you know, part of this team science and even team steps, these different frameworks. One of the common themes is having a shared vision and goal. And, you know, and kind of every once in a while having to go back to what really is your vision and your goal, and knowing that if reducing infections or reducing antimicrobial use is your goal, there are different ways to achieve that. And that's where the flexibility comes in. But kind of recentering on that goal and vision is always important.
And I think I'm going to take this moment to plug an APIC educational webinar that you can get online and sign up for. It's the Leadership in Management in IP. And there's a quote in there that hits on that, Dr. McKinley. And it's by author Seth Godin that says, you have to have commitment before you have success. And that's me paraphrasing it a little bit. But that is getting that group together with that shared goal. And you have to be committed to that.
Yes, I agree.
How would you describe the differences between doing something like this collaborative formation for antibiotic stewardship and infection prevention in an inpatient realm versus in an outpatient realm? Is it possible to do some of the same things in the outpatient area where we see a lot of prescribing happening and things like that and concern for infection prevention in those ambulatory areas?
Well, I definitely feel that there is tons of opportunities in the outpatient areas. So, yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, that infection prevention does tend to focus because of the acuity in the inpatient setting. However, I really do feel that there's been a huge expansion of infection prevention into other settings, not just inpatient, whether it's long-term care, outpatient, ambulatory surgery. So I really do feel that we're, getting our, feet wet and that we are expanding our boundaries into other areas and that yes, we should get involved. And if we're not pushed to get involved, I think there's tons of opportunities there.
Well, I sure hope this whole episode is beneficial then, because the first segment was focused on outpatient settings. And this can really help people put together the framework that maybe is needed to start addressing some of those outpatient areas a little more aggressively. Any final parting words that you'd like to leave?
I guess my parting words, because I've somewhat transitioned from clinical infection control into research, I've realized the importance of using different frameworks. And I guess I would put a plug into not dismissing these types of frameworks too easily, because it's hard to say whether these frameworks work until we start using them, and not only using them, but publishing our findings. So, the only way that we can see if these interventions or these frameworks work well is to have enough evidence that we can synthesize and put together and determine whether or not they're working. And if they're not working, are there ways to improve it, or do we need to move on? So I guess I would just plug, sometimes as a clinical infection preventionist, this seems more academic, but it's not. It's really to lay the groundwork for evidence.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. And thank you very much for the research that you've provided thus far. I think, as Nikki stated, this is really great information for infection preventionists to have out there so they can begin to work on forming these collaborative teams and making even more progress in their own organizations.
Yeah, synergy.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We are Nikki Shore and Jesse Swain, and this is the American Journal of Infection Control podcast, Science into Practice. Thanks for listening and doing your part to prevent infection, because remember, infection prevention is everybody's business. To hear other AGIC podcast episodes and to access information about this podcast in the field of infection prevention and control, go to our website at AGIC scienceintopractice.org. That's AGIC scienceintopractice.org.
AJEC Science into Practice is created by the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology with input from the APIC Research Committee and Pat Stone and Jean Brandt at AJEC and APIC staff, Lisa Tomlinson, Liz Garman, Bobby Gulshan, Chris Ruiz, Kelly Lynn Russell, Sylvia Quevedo, Kaylee Deaton, and Christine Miller. We work in partnership with Human Factor and Audio Tech Lake Alton.